From the campus of Weber State University, the Utah Debate Commission welcomes you to the first Congressional District Candidates Debate.
I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I'm honored to be invited by the Utah Debate Commission to moderate a debate between candidates in Utah's first congressional district. We're live on the campus of Weber State University in Ogden, and tonight we'll hear from the incumbent, Republican Representative Rob Bishop, and his Democratic challenger, Dr. Peter Clemens. We'll begin with opening statements. Each candidate will have 90 seconds. Prior to airtime, it was determined that Dr. Peter Clemens would have the first opportunity. Dr. Clemens, you have 90 seconds.
I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story and to tell you why I'm working to represent you in Congress. It's very important to me that I draw a clear distinction between my opponent and myself, because this election is so crucial to the people of Utah. We need to strengthen our economy. We need to clean up our air. We need to improve our education system. We need to protect our public lands, and we need to take better care of our veterans. This is our stewardship, and we can do better. I'm here to work for you. When my father was a young B-24 airman in World War II, he participated in one of the pivotal experiences in American history. On June 6, 1944, my father received a call from General Dwight Eisenhower about the mission that he was about to fulfill at D-Day. The message was simple: get out of bed and save the free world. I'm here tonight with that same sense of urgency to get out of bed and help protect the freedoms that we hold dear. As such, I'm a family man first. I love my wife, my six children, and my seven grandchildren. I've devoted my career to medicine, and I am a proud veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces. I've served in the public health, and I've taken care of our troops, and I had the experience of being in Haiti after the earthquake. I see my run for Congress as an extension of my life in public service. Thank you.
Thank you. And now a 90-second opening statement from Representative Rob Bishop.
Thank you. I want to thank Weber State for hosting this event and the Debate Commission for being wise enough to schedule it on the travel day for the Cubs. Because if this was tomorrow, I wouldn't be here. I'd be watching that game. With the exception of 2 years in Germany, I've spent my entire life in the First District. I live in Brigham City, where my wife and I raised our five kids, and we were fortunate enough to be able to send all five of them to college and on missions on a school teacher's salary. So I know how to budget, I know how to be frugal, and yeah, I even know how the experience of living paycheck to paycheck goes. Now I'm a former teacher who has the privilege of serving in Congress, lucky enough to be in a position where I can be of the greatest benefit to the state of Utah and the First District, and being in the right place to protect Hill Air Force Base and the defense workers who are there. As chairman of the Resource Committee, I can guarantee that Utah will have a voice on all public affairs issues on public lands. And also, I'm grateful that Speaker Ryan has placed me as one of the chairmen on his Article I task force, with the goal of trying to take power from the executive branch agency bureaucrats and move it back to the legislature where the founders envisioned it to be. But I'm also chairman of the 10th Amendment Task Force, so I'm not going to be satisfied until I move it from Congress back to the state and local governments where it should have been in the first place. Those are my goals for the next 2 years. And I'm asking for your vote so that I can take the values of Utah back to Washington and continue on with those policies and those efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. The Utah Debate Commission has established a format that allows each candidate 90 seconds for an initial reply to a question and 30 seconds for rebuttal. These questions were drawn from those submitted on the Utah Debate Commission website, utahdebatecommission.org. Our first question has to do with presidential politics. Both Republicans and Democrats have a controversial presidential candidate at the top of their party ticket. Who will you vote for and why? Peter Clemens, you have 90 seconds.
Thank you. I will tell you first and foremost that I will use my ballot to vote against Mr. Trump. I believe that Donald Trump is the least qualified man that I have seen in my lifetime to run for president. I believe that a man who calls women pigs and dogs and who openly advocates for sexual assault on women is unfit to be our president and the leader of the free world. I would also ask my opponent, Mr. Bishop, why it is that he feels that he should not retract his endorsement of Mr. Trump when most of the elected officials in Utah, including our governor, all of our congressional delegation, and Senator Mike Lee, have all retracted their endorsements of Mr. Trump. And in fact, I think what Mr. Lee said was very important. He said, I believe that everyone will have to make the decision for themselves, but I am voting on principle. And Mike Lee rescinded his endorsement of Mr. Trump because of principle. I would ask my opponent if he's not making a sacrifice of his principle to party politics. And I will leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Rob Bishop, 90 seconds.
Well, look, first of all, I have to say that what Mr. Trump has said about women and especially the institution of marriage can in no way be condoned. Being married for 39 years, I realize you cannot do and say what he actually said. However, every day for the last 2 years, I have worked with the Department of Interior, an organization that has simply ignored the law, flouted Congress, and written arbitrary rules and regulations that hurt Utah and hurt the education of our kids here in the state of Utah. 4 more years of Mrs. Clinton would mean the continuation of that process, which I simply find unacceptable. It would be a definite hindrance to the economic prosperity of this state and the potential funding of our kids. So of the options that I have, and they're not that many, it's a binary option right now, the only one who promises to give me a change in the status quo is Donald Trump. And that's why I'm going to vote for him, simply because the option of Mrs. Clinton is unacceptable.
30-second follow-up. So you say you have no other option, but there are third-party candidates. Why are you dismissing them? Rob Bishop, 30 seconds.
If those third-party candidates were viable candidates, then it would not be a binary option. Viability is something you may want, but it's not realistic to look at that. There is really one option. There's the option of Trump or the option of Clinton. The Clinton option is something that I think would be to the detriment of this state, and I cannot go there.
Mr. Clemens, you said that your vote is against Donald Trump. Are you for Hillary Clinton? 30 seconds.
First of all, let me say that actions by the Department of the Interior, I think, hardly rise to the level of completely distancing ourselves from our allies, saying that he will get out of NATO, providing and suggesting a religious litmus test. All of these things are things that Mr. Trump has said. And when we're looking and parsing what it is he said, I hardly think that these other things rise to that level. I will tell you that I have not made up my mind who I'm voting for in this election.
Thank you. Let's go on to national security. Recognizing the Boston Marathon bombings and the deadly shooting at an Orlando nightclub were committed by U.S. citizens and legal immigrants, what more should Congress do to prevent homegrown terrorism? And Mr. Clemens, you have 90 seconds.
Well, so I think the thing that we need to understand about these homegrown terrorists is, first of all, they are receiving their information and their marching orders, by and large, even these lone wolves, from other places. They're receiving their training, they're receiving radicalization from sources on the internet that they read about and come to believe are part of their own religious beliefs. Again, I think that we have a war here that's going on, and it is with radical jihadism and not with Islam. I believe that Mr. Trump, who Mr. Bishop is supporting, has called out the Muslims and said that we need to stop allowing Muslims to enter the country. I believe that a man like Donald Trump is the most dangerous person who we can possibly have as our president, because he goes a long way toward radicalizing not only those here at home, but also those abroad that would do us harm. Obviously, we need to have better communication between the NSA and between the FBI and the CIA and those organizations that will help to thwart these terrorist activities. But I am also very concerned that we don't roll back all of our rights in the Bill of Rights to accommodate these terrorists. Thank you.
And Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
Yeah, as you've seen, this is a significant issue. It's also a complex issue. And the ability of actually defending ourselves in this position goes back to the funding level that we have done for both our military as well as our intelligence community, both of which have been defunded significantly over the last 8 years. So the first thing we have to do is make sure that we have provided adequate for not only our intelligence community, but also for our defense community so they can be used appropriately in this particular situation. We also have a lot of people who are proposing that simply by attacking gun laws, you can have a solution to this issue. That simply is obviously not going to work because any of the proposals that have been out there so far would never have stopped any of the shootings to which you have referred. The other thing that we need to do is make sure that we have a good vetting process. The House has already staked out its position that if indeed we are going to welcome refugees into this country, there has to be a vetting process to be able to distinguish between those who seriously want to have a better life here in the United States and those that do pose a threat to our security. So all three of those areas are some of the things that need to be done if we're actually going to be more secure.
This is hardly a 30-second question, but that's all the time I'm allowed to give it. So you mentioned military funding. The Pentagon continues to press for military base closures. Should a recommendation come to close Hill Air Force Base, how would you respond? And Mr. Bishop, 30 seconds.
The fortunate thing is I don't think that's ever going to happen. The fact of the matter is Hill Air Force Base has a multi-base function that is highly prized by the military. So if they were going to make their decisions, I think Hill Air Force Base is in a better position than they have ever been to survive that. The fact that the F-35 would be bedded down here first says what the military thinks about Hill Air Force Base. So Hill Air Force Base, in fact, you could not financially move all the different programs that are at Hill Air Force Base to other places and do it with any kind of financial savings whatsoever. So I think if you're looking about what the military thinks about Hill, we're in great shape.
Mr. Clemens.
Well, I'm glad to hear Mr. Bishop talk about Hill Air Force Base. Hill Air Force Base brings $3.5 billion into our local economy. There are 23,500 employees at Hill Air Force Base. We cannot allow Hill Air Force Base to close. That said, the people who keep Hill Air Force Base open are the hardworking men and women who fulfill their mission at Hill Air Force Base, not a politician. Finally, I think that it's true that someone who can work with the new administration will be in a better position to keep Hill Air Force Base open than someone who has constantly antagonized the federal government.
Thank you. Let's turn to a student question. Krista Scott is here with us. Krista.
What legislation would you propose in Congress to address the challenge of making university and higher education more affordable for students? And is there additional action Congress could take to assist recent graduates as they enter the workforce?
Thank you, Krista. Mr. Bishop, you have 90 seconds.
Can I ask you to repeat that? It was hard to hear. I'm sorry.
What legislation would you propose in Congress to address the challenge of making university and higher education more affordable for students? And is there additional action Congress could take to assist recent graduates as they enter the workforce?
When it comes to education funding, especially on the secondary level, you got two practices that are a problem for kids. The first is actually the cost of tuition, and the other is the cost of student loans. Tuition still is going to be set by the state legislature and will be established by the state legislature. There are some things the federal government can do, like Pell Grants, which we have expanded in the past to make them easier to access to all kinds of students, but at the same time, that's really going to be a function of the state legislature. The other is the concept of student loans, which was doing a great job. Utah had a wonderful student loan program that was a public-private partnership until we passed Obamacare, which for some reason put a rider on there that said it wanted to federalize all student loans. Since that time, the Utah program, which was working and gave all sorts of opportunities for kids to pay back early, to change their interest rates if they were paying on time, it was a great program. It had to be stopped dead in the water. And since that time, it's much more difficult for kids to get loans, and it's also more bureaucratic for those type of loans. What we need to do is open up the process so we defederalize that concept of student loans so there can be more players in the games to help kids actually be able to fund those programs.
Mr. Clemens, 90 seconds.
So my opponent's party has suggested legislation to do away with SEOG grants, which are part of Title IV funding, as well as getting rid of the Perkins loans. Now, right here at Weber State, these loans are extremely important to students to be able to go to college and to matriculate. And there is no more important infrastructure in our country than our young people. Education should be and will always be the greatest engine of our economic growth. We have to be more committed to education, not only secondary education, but also college education. I would be strongly opposed to legislation to roll back any parts of the student loan program. I do think that we need to allow students greater latitude to refinance their loans. And I think that we absolutely need to have more economic teaching in our to our students who are coming into college about the amount of debt that they should take on based on what profession they're going into. I also, Mr. Bishop talked about healthcare. Healthcare is something that I've been involved in all my life. I've taught at a medical school. I've been involved in the healthcare field all my life. I'm aware of the fact that there are problems with the Affordable Care Act that need to be fixed, but a doctor will help to be able to address those better than someone who's a career politician.
Thank you. Mr. Bishop, 30 seconds for rebuttal.
Well, simply, the federal government destroyed the student loan program. They changed it when they tried to federalize everything. That's the problem. And getting them out of that system is going to be the solution to do that. And as far as the other programs that were mentioned, nothing personal, but I voted to reauthorize the Carl Perkins funds just before we left for this session. So there are a lot of us that are actually still supporting that kind of a concept. You can't make a blanket statement.
And Mr. Clemens, 30 seconds.
Well, again, I think that there is a lack of commitment. Mr. Bishop's party has been in office for the last 6 years, has controlled the House of Representatives, and for the last several years has also controlled the Senate. And so if there are laws that need to be passed to better the lot of students who are wanting to come to college, I guess I'm unclear as to why it is that his party has not moved forward with legislation that will help students. I believe that college education should be much more affordable for our students than it is presently.
Thank you. Another question from a student. Deborah Wilbur joins us. Deborah.
What actions do you think Congress should take to address the serious opioid epidemic taking place in the 1st Congressional District and across the country? As a recovering addict myself, I know the devastating impact drug addiction has on families and society.
Mr. Clemens, 90 seconds.
So I am a physician who prescribes a medication that is specifically to help people get off of their opioid addiction. I've done that for the last 10 years. And unfortunately, when a doctor graduates from medical school, there's really only one thing that he can write for on a prescription pad that will take care of pain, and that is an opioid. So obviously there are a lot of problems with physicians actually driving the opioid dependency that we see in America today. Lots of people, good people, are prescribed an opioid and 2 to 4 weeks later find themselves physically dependent on these medications. So certainly the president's increasing the amount of patients that I can treat in my office with this drug Suboxone is helpful. I also believe that doctors need other tools in their toolbox to help take care of chronic pain. And I agree with 65% of Utahns that it's time that we take a really serious look at medical cannabis. Medical cannabis can be scheduled and regulated and can be very helpful to patients, particularly with things like chronic pain due to cancer, where opioids are terrible because they make these people stop eating. Finally, I also think that there needs to be accountability of the pharmaceutical companies to take care of these opioids that people have not used and to allow patients to drop their opioids off, and the pharmaceutical companies need to be responsible for getting rid of them.
Representative Bishop, 90 seconds.
Thank you. The House has already passed a series of opioid legislation, which is still waiting on the Senate. And I wish the Senate would hurry up and pass that as well, because it would give greater flexibility to the states as well as to the federal government to actually address this particular problem. But I also want to have throw in here this concept of federalism, because one of the things that we have to realize is that many problems can easily be solved at a local and state level easier than they can be on the federal level, because the state and local governments have the ability of being more creative in their approach to a situation, and they can also include justice that takes place. they can look at an individual situation and have the greater opportunity of changing those factoids so they can actually help an individual. When stuff is done simply on the federal level, it becomes too big and too cumbersome, and people fall through the cracks and are therefore hurt, which is one of the reasons I'm happy that the House approach to it was to add more flexibility in the system and actually allow state and local governments to have the creativity to come into this process at the same time. All of those things have to work together in some particular way. And I hope it's successful. This is a major problem. This is something we need to deal with. And I'm assuming you're going to talk about marijuana sometime later because there's not enough time to go into that one either.
Well, let's do a quick follow-up, and let's do 45 seconds on this one. Do you support legalizing marijuana for medicinal purposes at the federal level? And Mr. Bishop, 45 seconds.
I'll go a step later, farther than that, by simply saying I don't think the federal government should be involved in this issue at all. It should be a state issue, and the state should have the right to legislate and to regulate as they wish. There is, for medical marijuana, some legitimate and justifiable purposes for which the state should be responsible. But at the same time, if it's simply recreational marijuana, even though I believe it's the state's rights to adjudicate that situation, I wouldn't want to live in a state that actually encourages and allows recreational use of marijuana. But as far as the entire issue, it's not a federal priority. It's not something the federal government should be involved in. It is something the state should be involved, and the state should have the priority in doing that.
And Dr. Clemens, 45 seconds.
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that I am not talking about recreational marijuana legalization. I do not support that. Second of all, I'm always puzzled by Mr. Bishop and when he starts talking about federalism, as if federalism somehow is small government and conservative. In point of fact, federalism would have us recreate an FDA and a DEA in every state to deal with these issues. That is not conservative. It's not fiscally conservative. It creates more government, not less government. Some of these things are simply better dealt with on a federal level. And I'm convinced absolutely that this is one of those issues where we do need direction and help and assistance from the federal government.
Thank you. Now let's move on to climate change. Arctic sea ice keeps melting, and NASA says the planet is warming more rapidly than at any time in the last 1,000 years. What actions should the U.S. take to slow global warming? And it looks like, Mr. Clemens, you have 90 seconds.
Well, I was really grateful when I saw on September 9th that Mr. Bishop had finally agreed to the fact that the planet is warming and that climate change is real. I am not a climate science denier. I believe that climate change is real, and I believe that it's anthropogenic. That means that we as humans have something to do with climate change. And you know, this is an issue that we'd better get right when we start talking about Utah, because this is something that will affect our snowpack, it will affect our water to our people. Our population is growing on the Wasatch Front, and we cannot have politicians who are not willing to confront reality and deal with things before they become a problem that we can no longer get back in the box. I do believe that greenhouse gases should be controlled. I believe that we need to continue to grow our economy, and I believe that Utah is uniquely positioned to begin to drive a clean energy revolution in our country. There is no place on the planet where we can do better with solar than we can in Utah. And so I support that. My opponent has pivoted when he was very early on as a lobbyist for EnviroCare and was bringing toxic nuclear waste that was described as hotter than hell into Utah. He pivoted from that to dependence on funding from oil and gas, the oil and gas industry. So I think it's obvious who Mr. Bishop is going to listen to when he pulls the trigger on legislation.
Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
Look, is there climate change? Of course. There always has been and there always will be. And man, as a part of nature, is a part of that issue as well. Whether man is totally responsible to it is actually insignificant, because true legislators, true lawmakers, when they deal with any legislation on this issue, has to look at the social cost of carbon, and they also have to look at the social benefit of carbon. and they have to balance both of those. Any legislation that comes from Washington that ignores one side or the other is bound to be wrong, and it's bound to cause more harm than benefit. And that's what we need to look at. And we need to realize also that affordable and efficient and abundant energy makes our lives worth living, and it also helps our economy by helping those who are on the lowest level of our income levels. So the thing that we have to deal with is, if you're going to look at legislation, do it intelligently and deal with both the benefit and the cost. To ignore one or the other is detrimental and should never be undertaken. I've got 28 seconds. Let me just say one thing. I hate to do this. I apologize. But going back to his last answer on federalism, he got the definition wrong. Federalism is not the same thing as small government. Federalism is neither liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat. Federalism is still giving people the options of the choices they want in their lives. If you have an area that wants a robust government, federalism says, yeah, you pay for it, do it, but you don't impose it on anyone else. And that's what federalism is to me. It's the ability of giving people a choice in how they want to live their lives.
Mr. Clemens, 30 seconds in rebuttal.
Well, I didn't hear a whole lot in that answer about climate change or what Congressman Bishop plans to do to curb climate change. I do support cap and trade or a carbon tax. I believe that there are all kinds of unintended consequences and taxes and expenses that happen to our economy because of polluters. And I think that this is also an issue that's rolled up with pollution right here on the Wasatch Front. People want clean air. Utahns have spoken.
Mr. Bishop, 30 seconds for a rebuttal.
There's nothing to rebut. What I says is, whatever program comes before Congress, we got to look at it realistically and logically and weigh the balance. That's what a responsible lawmaker has to do. I don't have a preconceived notion about what those are, but I want that balance to be weighed. If we don't, we create more harm than we do good. And the first rule of Congress should be, do no harm.
I want to do just a very brief follow-up on something that you said, Mr. Clemens. A clean energy revolution is what we need. Should the U.S. incentivize clean energy development? 30 seconds, Mr. Clemens.
Well, the idea that we've incentivized the oil and gas industry for decades and continue to do so, and that people from Mr. Bishop's party become so very upset about the notion of incentivizing the solar wind energy has always been silly to me. Absolutely, we should incentivize those industries. I am also not suggesting that we should not be continuing to develop all of our other energy sources. I am suggesting that we need to be pivoting as a country and having a clear energy policy that looks to the future, not backwards.
And Representative Bishop, 30 seconds.
Well, look, if one is talking about alternative energy programs, yeah, they should be encouraged in any way we possibly can. We get less than 10% of our energy, total energy in this country now, from alternative sources. If we could double it, that would be great. But at the same time, you don't do that by destroying the other sources of energy that are available. So it really is an all-of-the-above approach. And one must also realize that there's also some drawbacks to these. If you are indeed going to have a lot of solar energy, wind energy that takes place, it has to be built over here, but the people are there, and you have to have transmission lines that take it from one place to another. And yet we have a program and a foreign an administration that battles any kind of transmission line legislation that takes place. You got to do that if you're going to make it work.
Thank you. We are at the midpoint of our exchange tonight. I want to welcome you once again to this live debate between candidates for the 1st Congressional District. We're live on the campus of Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, and tonight's questions are drawn from those submitted to the Utah Debate Commission on their website, utahdebatecommission.org. We invite you to be part of the process, submit questions you'd like to see taken up at a future debate, and you can also find the full debate schedule as well as watch completed debates on demand. Now back to our exchange from a question with another student. Carver Nicholas joins us. Carver.
With so much tension rising with regard to race relations, what legislative actions can you take in Congress to help promote better, more polite civil relations among diverse communities and also interactions with the police?
Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
Yeah, you're talking about a significant issue that needs to be addressed. And I'm not going to go into the details of what police should or should not be doing as far as techniques or tactics. I'm not qualified to do that. But you're asking what Congress should be doing in this area. And let's face it, in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of legislation that was passed to provide equal access and equal opportunity. Legislation is not going to be the solution. There has to be something bigger and broader beyond that. That actually goes to the heart of individuals to change the way they think about one another. One of the things, and I don't want to harp about federalism, but I'm back on it, I just finished a book by Arthur Brooks, which he talked about when people are frustrated, it's because they think they are not heard and they are ignored. And what we really need to do is make sure that we can empower people so they feel that they are in control of their own lives in the areas in which they live. And I'm sorry, that's federalism again. This concept that the federal government should establish a policy, a one-size-fits-all for the entire country, actually de-emphasizes the individual and dehumanizes the individual. If we could actually start dealing with our programs, they are done at the local level, so that people, real people living in those areas, feel like they have a say, they're listened to, they are heard, they are not being ignored, then maybe this attitude can change, because we're talking about an attitude, and there's no piece of legislation that's going to change attitudes. But somehow it has to be with the government, schools, with families, with churches, all working together. There can be that readjustment of attitude, and it has to be. But I actually think Brooks is onto something, that if you let people feel like they're in charge of their lives, they feel better about their lives, and they don't have the level of frustration we've seen.
So just to underscore, Representative Bishop, Congress has no role in healing the wounds, the gaps in race relations today. 30 seconds.
No, I didn't say that. But what I said is legislation is not necessarily the solution to this. There has to be something else that takes place. And I think empowering people is the issue that's going to solve it. Legislation alone is not the solution. Are there some things Congress can do? Probably. And there may be ideas that come up there. But I don't want Congress to start to micromanage what our law enforcement agencies will have to do in the future. They should actually support them, but not micromanage them. And I think that's implicit in the follow-up question.
Mr. Clements, 30 seconds.
Well, I do think that eradicating poverty is extremely important to decrease the tension and violence in our inner cities. These are people, many of whom have never had a chance by virtue of their zip code where they were born, by virtue sometimes of what month of the year they were born in, frankly. So we know a lot about poverty. We need to work harder to give everyone a chance in life. An economy that only works for the elite is not an economy that works.
Thank you. Let's turn to immigration. For decades, Congress has failed to pass immigration reform bills, and executive action by the president has stalled in the courts. What meaningful solutions would you support to address border security as well as undocumented immigrants living in this country? And Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
Okay. This is a long one and it's a big one, but it's an important one. Because we have to realize, and probably every town hall meeting I've had, if it's not the first question, it's usually the second or third, deals with immigration and illegal immigration. C.S. Lewis once said, if you do first things first, second things will be added to it. If you do second things first, you will accomplish neither first nor second things. And one of the things we have to realize in this issue is there are a lot of issues out there that deal with immigration that I think are easily solvable. But the first thing that has to take place is we have to have the ability of looking our people in the eye and saying, yes, we control the borders, so that you can diminish the amount of anger and anxiety and angst that is out there on this issue. And if you're going to do that, then you can move on and accomplish a whole lot of other things. But that is the first step. And the sad part of the situation is our inability of controlling the borders has one root in it, and it's the inability of allowing the Border Patrol to do their jobs. If you look from California to Texas, 80% of that land is owned by the federal government. Over 50% is in wilderness category where the Border Patrol is not allowed to do any kind of motorized surveillance of what they are doing, unless it's in hot pursuit, which cannot be defined. I've been to the border. I've talked to the Border Patrol. I've talked to the people who live down there. We don't need a wall, and we don't need more money, and we don't need more manpower. What we need to do is in that zone that's known as the border zone, to allow the Border Patrol to have access to do their jobs and to monitor it. If we did that, we could control the border, and then we could look to people and say, yeah, we are in the position now to move forward. And I think those other positions, those other solutions, are going to be pretty easy to solve, but it won't happen until you can lower the anger level. And that has to happen by being able to say, we can control the border.
Thank you. Mr. Clements, 90 seconds.
Well, first of all, the idea of deporting 12 million Americans, most of whom are contributing to the economy, is terribly unrealistic. Also, the candidate who my opponent supports, Mr. Trump, suggests that those people coming across our border are murderers, thugs, and rapists, and that he will build a wall and make the Mexicans pay for it. The truth is that 57% of the people who are here undocumented came into our country through airports like the Salt Lake City International Airport and overstayed their visa. So if we're going to build a wall, we're going to need to build an awfully big wall because it's going to need to go around all of our international airports, including the Salt Lake City International Airport. I want to say that I support a pathway to citizenship. I also support the DREAM Act. I want to give a shout out to my son-in-law. My son-in-law's family came across the border from Mexico and settled in Los Angeles. My son-in-law was born in Los Angeles. He is active Army. He has served his country in Iraq. And he and all of his siblings have either graduated from college or are going to college. I'm so proud of my son-in-law. And under the administration of Mr. Trump, he would be likely to lose his citizenship, even though he has served his country in the military. Such a thing is just unthinkable.
Thank you. I want to follow up, since immigration and national security are so tied together, would you block Syrian refugees from entering the U.S.? And I'll give Mr. Bishop 30 seconds.
Actually, I already answered that in one of the earlier questions. We've already taken a position in the House and voted for that particular bill that says we'll allow them to come in there after the Homeland Security has established their vetting system so that you can make a distinction between those seeking a new life and those who are a threat to our security. The vetting system has to be in there in the first place. As soon as that's done, we're ready to go.
And Mr. Clemens, 30 seconds.
Well, I think all of us were shocked as a people when we saw that picture of that little boy in Aleppo. That picture went viral. And those are frequently the type of people that we're talking about. And so I do agree that these people need to be very, very thoroughly vetted. But many of these people are graduates of college, have graduate degrees. They can contribute to our society, and they need a second chance. They're not refugees of their own choice. We do need to make sure that they're not terrorists first before we bring them into our country. But that can be done. I also salute the state of Utah, which sets a standard for the whole world in terms of its embracing of refugees.
Time. Thank you. Let's move on to public lands. What do you think is the appropriate role of the federal government in managing and maintaining public lands? And Mr. Clemens, 90 seconds.
Well, this is probably an area where I differ more from my opponent than on any other issue. So there is a bill that's in Congress, the Public Lands Initiative, that I believe is a massive oil and land grab. It's also a land grab of 100,000 acres from the Ute Indian tribe. This law was written by my opponent. It's the first Indian land grab in over 100 years and takes land that belongs to the Ute Indians in the Ouray and Uinta Reservation. On the issue further, there is also a fund. It's called the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And this fund, Mr. Bishop, actively defunded last October, November. He is the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, and as such, he was allowed to let the funding lapse for that fund. The truth is that Ogden, the city of Ogden, is in negotiations for a 1,400-acre parcel in iconic Waterfall Canyon that will be dependent on federal funds through the Land and Water Conservation Fund to buy that parcel of land to keep open a trail that everyone in Ogden uses and that people come from around the world to use and that has been used by the people in the state of Utah for over 100 years. My opponent allowed that funding to lapse. Thankfully, a bipartisan effort of Congress went over his head, reestablished the funding for an additional 3 years for the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
Okay, Jennifer, do you want me to talk about PLI or the question that you asked?
The appropriate role of the federal government.
All right, then I'll go back to the appropriate question. I'd like to go back to some of the assertions that were made about PLI because they're basically inaccurate. But for the proper role of government, this is the hard part. the federal government owns one-third of America, and it's disproportionately in the West. If you go east of Denver, the federal government only owns 4% of America. For us, it's over 54%, and that's basically that low because California, Montana, and Colorado have a lot of their own land that's not owned by the federal government. So the question is, who can best manage that land? I don't think that the people in Washington are evil or bad or ineffective or incompetent. They just have too much damn land to manage, and it doesn't work. And that's been a historical pattern of this country. After the Civil War, when we passed all sorts of homesteading acts, every one of them failed because they were administered by people who were living thousands of miles away from the area in which they were being administered. So what we can show is, as we look at what states do on their lands and the tribes do on their lands, they are far more efficiently and effectively managed than what the federal government can do on their lands, primarily because there is too much for the federal government still to hand. If we were to divide up this process so that we allowed smaller entities to be able to manage these lands, then we could be more effective, and then we could do things that actually help people with that particular process. And that's what we basically were trying to do with the PLI.
Mr. Clemens, 30 seconds to rebut.
Well, I know that the Ogden mayor, because I've spoken with him on this issue, is very nervous about the idea of the state taking back our federal lands. He believes that we will have to create an entire new bureaucracy, and that this will be hundreds and hundreds of jobs, and that the state is not ready to do that. I spoke with a firefighter on Saturday who has spent his lifetime fighting fires, including the Pioneer Fire up in Idaho, and he warned me that this could be an absolute budget wrecker for the state of Utah, because if the federal government gets out of the business of taking care of our federal lands, we are now on the hook for fire suppression. This fire up in Idaho cost over $200 million to suppress. Let's think about that before we start agitating for the federal government to give up its lands.
Representative Bishop, 22 seconds.
Can I get the 22 he went over? Can I
get
that one? Okay. Look, this idea that the state can't afford this is ridiculous. The state has been looking forward to this and looking ahead. The state of Utah has specifically passed legislation on how they would manage the land if it was in their purview and how they would fund it if it's in their purview. They have done studies that said it's not going to be this devastating impact financially for the state of Utah. The state is prepared. The state is ready. They are equally as competent as the federal government. And to assume that only somebody in Washington has the ability of making these decisions and making this management is ridiculous. And it also would not be a net loss for the taxpayers of the state of Utah. You could actually have a benefit from it. Studies have shown that. The state's done their homework. The state's ready to do it. Give them an opportunity.
I think I know the answer to my follow-up question, but I'm going to give you 30 seconds anyway. If Interior Secretary Sally Jewell asked you for input on a Bears Ears National Monument, what would you tell her? And Mr. Clemens, 30 seconds.
Well, first of all, I think that the best way to settle all of these lands disputes is with reasonable, smart legislation. Unfortunately, the Public Lands Initiative that my opponent wrote was none of those things, and it was not a compromise between oil and gas and people who want to use the land, like the backcountry hunters and anglers, who would be denied access under Mr. Bishop's plan. And so I believe that the best pathway would have been legislation to take care of this area. It has not, and so I do support a monument in the Bears Ears.
And Mr. Bishop, 30 seconds.
Unfortunately, she has asked my advice, and I have told her that advice, and that's the worst thing that could possibly be happening. For the president to abuse the Antiquities Act, that's what this would be. The Antiquities Act has three criteria before it can be used. None of those criteria exist. First of all, you have to have an antiquity. A tree is not an antiquity. But under the Obama administration standard, they also believe that if there's popular support, you should do it. There is no popular support among the Native Americans who live in Utah. They've all passed resolutions and written op-eds in opposition to it. What we tried to do in the PLI is come up with a process that was from them, from the bottom up, that allows them to have cooperative management, which once again the federal government talks about, but they can't do it. I'm 10 seconds over. I apologize. There are a whole lot more I could say about this. A monument's the absolute worst thing you should do. Go down there and listen to their slogan down there is Duda Monument, which is the Navajo word for no monument.
Mr. Clemens, do you want the 22 seconds, or would you like to go to a student
question? Yes, I would. Well, first of all, the Antiquities Act that Mr. Bishop said, if anybody believed in it, they should die and take their stupidity out of the gene pool, is the way that we got 5 national parks in Utah. That's how all of these parks started. Also, I think that Mr. Bishop's friends like to handpick the Native Americans who they have speak against the national monument. I have seen far different statistics about the number of Native tribes who have lived on this land for millennia, who want to preserve this land and know that the Public Lands Initiative does not protect it. Therefore, they say, we want the monument.
I think the distinctions are crystal clear. Thank you, gentlemen. Let's move on to another student question, and Marissa Baham joins us.
What do you think is the purpose of the Second Amendment today? Do you think that if Congress strengthened gun control, it really would reduce crime rates?
And Mr. Bishop, 90 seconds.
I'm sorry, I won't take 90 seconds on this one. Second Amendment is an individual right of self-defense, and that's how it should be looked at, and that's how it should be done. Every proposal that has been indicated so far to try and deal with some of the horrific mass shootings that we have had would have been absolutely nothing to solve that particular problem. There is a problem of illegal use of guns, but to try and solve illegal use by attacking the legal use of a legal owner who is not abusing his gun is counterproductive, and it simply won't happen that way. There is something that we need to do that deals once again with the more significant issue, and that is the heart of individuals who are doing these kinds of things that are illegal activities. Somehow we have to work through and realize that our nation has become much more violent. I don't know if that's because of the entertainment, video games we're playing, the cavalier attitude we have to life at the beginning of the cycle with abortions, a cavalier attitude at the end with euthanasia that has changed and made us desensitized to other people, but in some way that has to change. You can't do that by legislation alone, but the government needs to work with schools and churches and families. This is a problem that can be solved at the breakfast table by doing things that can invigorate and empower the homes to come up with better solutions. But as far as trying to change gun laws, all of the proposals have been counterproductive and would not have solved any of the problem, and I don't support those.
Dr. Clemens, 90 seconds.
Well, first of all, let me say that I am a gun owner. I believe I'm a responsible gun owner. I learned how to use a weapon when I was in the military, and I believe that the rights enshrined in the Second Amendment should absolutely be protected. I do think that there are a few things that can be done, that according to recent polling done by Public Policy Polling, 72% of NRA members support universal background checks for guns. 81% of gun owners support universal background checks on guns. When I recently bought a gun, I went through a fairly exhaustive process that took half an hour, 45 minutes, and I was happy to have it done because I believe it protects not only others, but it protects me. Some of the things that I think are crazy are that people who are on terrorist watch lists can get guns. Obviously, mental health, funding. As a doctor, I've watched this steady erosion in mental health services in our country. We're now paying the price for that, I believe. And so we absolutely need to attack this from a mental health standpoint, because a lot of the people who are perpetrating this violence are doing so because they are, frankly, mentally ill. And they shouldn't be able to buy guns.
Thank you. I would do follow-ups, but our time is fleeting. I want to squeeze in one last student question. This is Dallin Zog.
What do you believe the state of religious freedom is with the state of Utah and the country as a whole? What can Congress do to preserve religious freedom while maintaining toleration?
And this is going to have to be an abbreviated answer of 40 seconds, gentlemen. Mr. Clemens.
Freedom to pursue one's and to live one's religion is enshrined in the First Amendment to the Constitution. It is sacred, and most of our forefathers came to this country seeking religious freedom. So I am a very strong supporter of religious freedom. I am also a strong supporter of rights for all people. And I believe that when rights for people intersect with rights to practice one's religion, the best way to handle that is through tolerance of the individuals who are involved.
And Mr. Bishop, 40 seconds, please.
Okay. You've hit on a significant issue that we'll deal with, we're dealing with now and we'll deal with in the future. But it's one that simply says, if you want to look at what the federal government needs to do in this issue, what we need to do is make sure that we pass no laws which prohibit the ability of people actually to function in their free exercise of religion. It is a First Amendment guarantee. There are ways you can try and piddle around with that should never be tolerated, should never take place. It is a constitutional right. At the same time, if you're looking at the freedom of religion versus other groups, as has been mentioned already, there should be no conflict in that. And I think the state of Utah did a great job when they came up with legislation to try and put all those things in balance without infringing on anyone's free exercise of religion. He's right. The First Amendment constitutional right has to be respected. I hit it.
You hit it. Thank you very much. Our time is nearing an end. So we'll move to 1 minute closing statements. And Dr. Clemens, you go first.
Throughout this election cycle, my opponent has asked you to reelect him because he is powerful in Washington. To me, that is the embodiment of all that is wrong in Washington, D.C. The Declaration of Independence says, we the people, not we the powerful. Unlike my opponent, I'm not intoxicated by power or beholden to special interest. I'm an independent voice for a healthy Utah. And I believe that it's exactly that background that will allow me to help cooperate, collaborate, and work across the aisle to help move things forward that the American people want us to deal with. I also pledge to you that I will never forget who I'm beholden to, which is you, the people. I pledge that I will never serve more than 3 terms in Congress, and then I will come home. When my father answered the call on D-Day, I'm sure he never thought to ask his fellow crewmen whether they were Democrats or Republicans. They were Americans, period. Ladies and gentlemen, we stand at a pivotal moment in our history. When you mark your ballots, please vote Peter Clemens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Bishop, 1 minute.
Thank you. You know, when I was first elected to Congress, I made one promise, and that promise was that Washington wouldn't change me. I kept that promise. I am the same as I was before, a conservative, an old teacher, and I am have the opportunity of serving in Congress and able to take your values back with me. But when I leave this office, the one thing I want to be able to do is to look constituents in the eye and say, the federal government has less control of your lives now than when I first arrived. I am committed to that goal. I will continue to be committed to that goal, as well as being committed to proper funding of our military, to the recognition and respect of our defense workforce, to making sure that education is controlled locally and not in Washington, to maintain my 100% pro-life voting record, to ensure that we vote for the leanest budgets, to not raise taxes so that you can keep more of your hard-earned money, at the same time to ensure the Second Amendment is an individual right of self-defense and maintain that, and to also say that Utah will have control of their lands and their destiny so that they can fund their education system properly. I ask for your vote because I want to take those ideas back so that we can empower people, not empower the federal government. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My thanks to Rob Bishop and Peter Clemens for your time today, a spirited exchange and very informative. Special appreciation to the administration, faculty, and students of Weber State University for graciously hosting this debate. I'd also like to thank the co-chairs of the Utah Debate Commission, Scott Howell and Thomas Wright. The final debate this election cycle is Wednesday, October 19th at 6 o'clock, featuring candidates from Utah's 3rd Congressional District. If you'd like to attend that event at Utah Valley University, or you have a question you'd like to submit for consideration, visit the Utah Debate Commission website at utahdebatecommission.org. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Please exercise your right to vote on November 8th. In Ogden, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good evening.